All right. This is the New Glarus Brewing Podcast with Dan Carey. I am Scott May. We have a kind of a special deal today, don't we, Dan?
That's right.
I always like when you invite one of your friends to the podcast because we always end up talking to someone really cool. I think this is our second time doing this. We're going to be talking with Mark Carpenter from Anchor Brewing.
Yeah.
How you doing, Mark?
I'm glad you considered me really cool.
You know what? I do consider you really cool. I consider anyone sort of connected with Anchor Brewing really cool because it has occupied this space in my mind for a very long time of a kind of brewery that I think is just sort of quintessentially American, like forgetting about its history stretching back to the late 1800s. It sort of defined a style in steam beer, but then also the iconography of Anchor Brewing. It's that Sailor Jerry thing. It's everything about it just to me screams like really kind of just a cool, iconic American brewery.
It's iconic San Francisco.
Yeah.
It was. And the first time I went there, it was exactly all of those things. And it was in the late 60s. And we'd lived through the 60s in San Francisco, which were amazing times for a lot of reasons. And people were exploring all kinds of different lifestyles. You know, you had the whole hippie movement going on and all the music in San Francisco and people just experimenting with lifestyles. And I had gotten out of high school and went to work. And some point I decided that I'd been working for about 10 years or 9 years that I wanted to have something different in my lifestyle. And I'd never traveled. So I wound up quitting work and traveled for a couple of years. And halfway through that time, I went on a tour of the Anchor Brewing Company. And like I said, as soon as you enter the place, it was unbelievable. This was the old brewery, not on Pechoro Hill.
Yeah.
Beautiful little tap room, beautiful little building and crowded little brewery. Had a copper kettle, 57 barrel copper kettle, had a great tour and drank a lot of beer. And it was about 6 months later, I decided I'd really like to see if I could get a job there. So I went back and asked for a job, and I was lucky enough to get in to meet Fritz, and he hired me.
Wow.
At that time, there were only three of us in the brewery, and there was the woman who ran the office and Fritz. And so it was just an unbelievable place. We had, when Fritz bought the brewery, let me back up a little bit. When Fritz bought the brewery, there was only one pump in the whole brewery. And that pumped the hot work from under the kettle up to the cool ship in the top of the building. And everything else was by gravity from there. And the beer sat in the cool ship overnight, then was pitched into a little round fermenter that wasn't being used when I was there, and then into a rectangular fermenter after that, with no cooling anywhere in the building, no refrigeration anywhere. But it was San Francisco. So in the summertime, it could be quite cool at the brewery. It probably never went on average above 60 to 65 in the brewery. And the same for winter. In the fall, you'd get a few hot days. But other than that, it was a very steady climate. And no stainless steel, iron lined tanks. And Fritz bought it. And you mentioned that he had Maytag money, but he doesn't have anywhere near that what I think most people think he has. And I asked him a couple of times, you know, what or other people did, and I did too, you know, what he paid for the brewery. And I never really got a real straight answer, but he says, well, I didn't pay any more than you pay for a car at the time, because he was really buying nothing. He was buying some debt, and the equipment was all needed upgrading and replacing. But Fritz had this vision. He really liked it. He realized its historical significance. he learned about it because he drank steam beer at the old spaghetti factory in North Beach. And it was the only draft beer they ever had. And the owner there told Fritz that he should go try and see the brewery because it's getting ready to go out of business. And it was a real part of California history, and it's going to be gone, and he should go look at it. Not that he should buy it, but just that he should go look at it. And so he did. And like so many of us, I'm sure Dan included, you get in a brewery, they're just kind of magic places, you know, especially if you like mechanical things and just, you know, all the pipes and the kettles and everything. They really are magical places. And Fritz really kind of fell in love with it. And he bought into, actually at that point, I think half the brewery, and started to really change things. He built a tiny little lab, cleaned up a little room, and built a lab to teach himself about brewing and to teach himself how to make good beer and to be able to test throughout the process. There was really no testing going on when he took over. And then he was started the bottle in 1971, early 71. And so, that's when I came along. I came along in the fall of 71.
Oh, wow. And, you're on like really early after Fritz takes over, only like what, 6 years later?
Yeah. And like I said, there were three of us in the brewery and the secretary and Fritz. And so when we brewed, we all brewed, which wasn't very often because we were doing a 57 barrel brew size. And when you're not really selling much beer, it takes a long time. So when we brew, we'd all brew. When we bottle, we all bottle. And we actually bring in a couple of part-timers for bottling. One of the part-timers who would come in was an artist named Wes Wilson. And if you Google him, he's responsible for a lot of the famous Fillmore posters that are real, actually hard to read, a lot of them.
Oh, sure.
And they're very unique, you know.
Sure.
And Wes, along with some other people, did those posters. And he came in on bottling days to help us bottle. And it was just an unbelievable place to learn brewing. When the day I started, Fritz gave me an old edition of the Master Brewer's book on brewing. And it was an edition that was very thin compared to their other ones.
Yeah, the 1945
and it was kind of
edition.
Question and answer form.
Yeah. 1945.
Yeah, I took that home and read it through. I thought, I know everything I need to know.
Yeah.
I read the book.
Yeah. And then a couple of years later, I realized I'll never know everything I need to know.
Yeah.
That seems to be the life cycle of a brewer is, holy crap, I got my hands around this thing. Yeah. I got it wrangled. And then 2 seconds later, I don't know nothing about this.
The more you know, the less you know.
So, exactly.
And
you were growing up, you were a young kid at this time in San Francisco.
Yeah, that's right. I was born in 1960.
I was born in 43. And so in 71, you know, I was 27, 28, something like that.
Getting your career underneath you.
Getting my second career. And, best move I ever made. It just turned out to be this unbelievable career. Fritz was such an amazing man to work for. He surrounded himself with people that he liked working with, and he gave us such good opportunities to all of us who kind of stepped forward and wanted to be part of it. You know, the number of trips I made to Europe to either learn brewing methods for different types of beer, or to go to equipment shows in England or in Germany, or to go see certain equipment in action. So a lot of, you know, he didn't hesitate to send us around to learn as much as we could, which in hindsight, it's really interesting because we were going to Europe to learn all the different kinds of European beer making. Nowadays, it's the world, beer world turned upside down from when I started. America is the leader in the beer world by leaps and bounds, by far. You go to Munich today and go into a bar or small brewery there, you're going to be drinking an IPA.
Yeah, a hazy IPA.
Yeah, which in many of those countries, they don't call IPAs. They're all IPAs.
IPAs, yeah, yeah.
Well, what's the European pale ale?
Well, just because in German, I is pronounced E.
Oh, okay,
and
gotcha.
So they say, instead of saying IPA, they call them IPAs. Or in South America, IPAs.
IPAs, that's awesome. Yeah. That is really cool.
Yeah.
Growing up in San Francisco, how were you aware of the Anchor Brewing Company when you were like in your teens, or how did you become acquainted with it?
I was aware of it from very early on. I was aware of it because in Sausalito near my aunt's house, there was a bar that had steam beer signs outside. And when I was a little kid, I was never a good reader, and I thought I must be reading this wrong because steam and beer don't go together, you know?
Yeah.
So I asked my dad once, what was that steam beer? So, yeah, I knew about it for various reasons. The first time I ever had it was, I think, 1963 at Leroy's Hooch House in Napa, California. And Leroy's was just a great bar.
That's an awesome name for a bar.
It was a beer bar. And it opened at 6 in the morning because Leroy worked at Naval Shipyard at Mare Island. And so he opened at 6 in the morning for all the crew that lived in Napa that were getting off their work, you know, at the yard. They'd stop by there and have a beer in the morning. And then he went all day, you know, to I don't know what time at night. But so I was in there and I was asking him about steam beer. I said, I want to try one of those steam beers. And they had two. They had steam beer and then steam beer dark. And I said, well, which should I try? He said, oh, I've never had it. I said, you better start with the light, you know. So I said, okay. So I had this steam beer. And it was not bad. It, to the best of my memory, it really tasted like an English mild. It kind of had kind of a fruity flavor. I'm sure there was all kinds of bacteria. It was hazy, and so I'm sure there was bacteria or whatever, you know, or wild yeast or yeast in it. And it had kind of a fruity flavor to me, but I didn't mind it at all. I thought it was kind of good. I've always liked English milds. So I had a few and I said, should I have one of those darks? He said, next time you come try the dark or something. So I never did have the dark. Now, years later, I learned that the dark was all it was a regular steam with caramel coloring added. And I used to be part of that because we'd fill the kegs. And they were old Golden Gate kegs, and they'd have a wooden bung. And so you'd fill the keg through the bung hole, and then, but before you'd fill it for the dark, you had a big copper pitcher there, and they'd pour in the caramel coloring, you know? And then you'd fill the keg and send it off. And there was one bar in Sausalito, the no-name bar, that sold a lot of the dark. And one time they complained that the dark didn't seem to be all that dark, you know. So I said, next time I was filling the kegs, I'll cure that. Just pour in more caramel color. So that was a big difference. And I think that was honestly how, you know, there were so many small breweries around the U.S. Back in those days. There was still Wisconsin, Stevens Point, and they're all going
Walters.
Away right now.
Liney Kugels and Walters.
Yeah, oh, yeah, Liney Kugels for sure. I visited Liney Kugels and Stevens Point. And there was also, you know, the Hofbra, the guys who did beer for the Hofbra House in Chicago.
Oh, Berghoff.
I remember Berghoff. Berghoff beer.
You talking about Huber in Monroe.
Yeah, Huber. Brewing. Yeah.
Dave Radzinowski. I don't know if you remember him. Dave Radzinowski.
Who's that?
Dave Radzinowski. He was brewmaster.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Mostly what I remember about Huber beer is the stuff I don't remember.
Yeah.
Also, Shiner in Texas.
Yep.
Was famous for its pot.
Yep.
And they may have used grains. I'm not sure. But I think that most of the brewers around the country, when they'd make their bock in the springtime, just use caramel.
Oh, color. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like,
well, this is interesting to me because what you're bringing up is stuff from like the very before we even had like words for it, right? Like there wasn't a craft beer scene. There wasn't a craft beer movement.
The beer writer Michael Jackson was the one that came up with a lot of this categorizing of beer because before him, beers weren't really categorized.
I mean, it was just beer and other stuff.
Yeah.
But these stories are awesome because, you know, you came on in 71. I think the modern craft beer movement isn't credited even really starting until like, 85, 86, somewhere in there?
Yeah, you know, you could say New Albion. They started probably, I think, in the late 70s, maybe. Yeah. But they were kind of a short-lived brewery, so probably the longest-standing one would probably be, the longest survivor, I guess, would be Sierra Nevada.
Yeah,
Sierra, for sure.
So when you guys are brewing, what are you sort of considering yourselves? Or are you just not considering it at all and just like, we're just making our beer?
Yeah, I think Fritz actually invented the term microbrewer because he was always asked, well, what are you? You know, what? And at that time, the computers were coming to the forward and people were using them. And micro-publishing was kind of being invented.
Okay.
There were these different micro-publishing houses because of easy access to computers. And I think Fritz was talking to one of those guys and said, well, you know, you should understand what we are. You're a micro-publisher. We're a micro-brewer. And that name kind of caught on. And then there's always arguments over what size you had to be a micro. Yeah.
When do you bump up?
Yeah, 6 million barrels.
There you go.
The Brewers Association, as we grew, I don't know what they had against Fritz, but they set the number for a micro brewer just under what we were making.
Yeah.
until Sierra passed it.
Well,
that's hilarious.
Well, plus
and then they switched.
Plus they always pushed it up to make sure that Sam Adams stayed. So, you know, they were going. They eventually went a microbrewery. I think a craft brewery ended up being a 6 million barrel brewery.
Yeah.
So it's kind of all politics and semantics.
Well, yeah, it's not wanting to alienate any of the larger players.
Yeah.
Well. It was funny how they changed it to above us when Sierra passed us. But then they decided they changed their different names, like regional brewery or national brewery.
Well, it was always a funny thing for us, Mark, because we only sell in the state of Wisconsin. And when we got above 15,000 barrels, they said, you are now what we're going to call a regional brewery. So I said to them, I said, well, we're not a regional brewery. We only sell in Wisconsin. Well, because you're over 15,000 barrels, you're now categorized as. So it's like dealing with the government. And I always had a problem because, you know, talking about old breweries, August Shell Brewery in New Ulm, Minnesota is an iconic craft brewer from day one.
Yes.
And they were not allowed in because they used Horror of Horror corn in their beer. And and you had to be all malt, which is, ludicrous in America that you have to make 100% malt beer. And this iconic family-run brewery that is a epitome of craft beer was not allowed into the club.
That's really funny.
I agree. That's another brewery I visited a few times. They were a nice family and the brewery is just beautiful. Obviously.
Oh yeah.
You must have been there.
Yes. Yeah. But I want to tell you is the story of the first time that I ever had Anchor beer. I grew up, my dad drank Olympia and so I would get a sip of his beer when I was a little kid, and I always loved beer. And I was helping a neighbor do some yard work. They were installing a brick patio, and at that time, it was probably about the time that you were starting, Mark. I was probably 13 or so. So that would have been 1973. And so I was, I was laying, we were laying bricks, and he said, "Hey, you want a beer?" I said, "Sure." And he opened up a bottle of Anchor Steam Beer. And I had never had it. Of course, I'd seen, like Mark, I had seen, you know, I seen the signs around town and in front of taverns, but it was like, going, if all you had eaten your whole life was Wonder Bread, and then someone gave you like a whole grain sourdough bread, it was like, it was dark and malty and bitter and big and sweet and aromatic. It was like beer concentrate, and it really shocked me. Like, wow, now this is beer.
Just opened your whole mind.
Yeah, it was really the first time that I had a really impactful beer.
That those kind of stories are amazing, especially when you're talking about a brewery with as long a history as Anchor. Because I can remember when I had my first Anchor beer as well. They came in a little bit fatter of a bottle, so the bottle was like a little, shorter.
It didn't have shoulders. It had nice, elegant slope.
Yeah, and I was probably like 16, 17, somewhere in there. And, you know, as we kind of talked about before, I was like, me and all my friends were really into punk rock back then, right? It was like, you know, we were doing the whole thing into punk rock, SoCal and San Francisco scene, all those bands and stuff. And a lot of them would reference Anchor Steam, like, you know, that sort of thing.
Funny.
So I remember I was at like a house party and someone had got like their older brother and like, I sent him out to get Anchor. We're going to try some Anchor today. And you try like, oh, this is a really good beer. Yeah. And I just remember the logo on it.
Yeah.
Just looking beautiful. So beautiful.
Well,
that cool.
Heavy wine stock paper was also unique, that kind of craft look.
Yeah. It was just so cool. So being sort of in the middle of that, Mark, were you sort of aware of sort of the place Anchor sort of held in people's imaginations?
Yeah. After things, even from the beginning, because before there was any competition or other breweries, the people who came to we had tours, and we used to have to take turns giving tours. And the people who sought out Anchor knew about it. They came to us and they were always impressed and happy to be there. And so it gave me a great feeling, you know, about what you were doing for a living, you know. And also very early on, Arnold Schwarzenegger filmed a part of an episode of The Streets of San Francisco at the brewery.
Oh, geez.
And, and so then, you know, that appeared and people say, oh, you're on television, you know? So anyway, I kind of always had a feeling, but then as things grew, as Dan said earlier, pardon me, everybody came to Anchor to see it if you were thinking of starting a brewery. And so we met everyone who was going to start a brewery. And I remember hearing about this brewery opening up in Arizona, and they had never come to see us. And I thought, how could they do that? How could they start a brewery without coming to see us? So then shortly after that, a couple of decades later, the rate of growth in breweries just started to skyrocket, you know? I forget what the exact number of breweries was in the U.S. when I started there, but it was under 100, but I think it was over 50. But now, what is it?
10,000.
Oh, yeah.
10,000.
10,000, yeah.
Yeah. The first brewery that I ever worked at was a brewery in Helena, Montana. And my bosses actually came and sat with Fritz. And Fritz was always very kind because, you know, he's trying to build a business, but anybody who wanted to start a brewery would make a pilgrimage to the city, and they would sit in Fritz's office, and Fritz would, you know, talk to them, and he made a big impression on a lot of people.
Well, that's an amazing sort of service to do, and I know you know, a lot of the stuff that Mark is saying, you know, it's sort of mirrored in the way you guys sort of have run your business too, of being sort of open, being willing to talk people through, being sort of committed to you know, getting the right equipment in the right place and building sort of the iconography from like the ground up, I guess.
Well, you know, when I started in the brewing business, there was like 9 craft breweries. We were like, I worked in the 9th startup craft brewery in the early 80s. So it's a lot different now with 10,000. I mean, there's a brewery pretty much like Starbucks on every corner.
Yeah.
But you know, when here at this Riverside Brewery across the street was going to be a blue cheese factory. And that would have probably be, I don't know, 12 years ago that someone was going to build a blue cheese factory. And Fritz Maytag actually came to visit because his family makes blue cheese.
Oh,
Maytag,
yeah.
Blue cheese. He came to check out what these guys were doing. And he came, I was gone, but he met with Deb. And I guess they had a very nice conversation. He was a real gentleman, and he ended up writing a handwritten letter thanking Deb for her time follow up, which is a typical example of, you know, he comes from a different generation. Mm-hmm. when people were maybe more cordial, more professional than they are now. So that was kind of fun for Deb to be able to sit with and visit with Fritz.
Did you ever get to meet Fritz, or was that like the ships of the night moment?
No, because I've been to the Anchor Brewery many times, and sometimes they have a really nice iconic bar, old bar. It's probably way, you know, from the original brewery, but they had it set up, and so if you went for a tour, often Mark might be there serving beer, and often Fritz was there to talk to the tour. You know, the tour might be, I don't know, 5, 10, 20 people.
Yeah.
And they always, Mark and all the brewers wore like a white jumpsuit and with their names on it. So they were always, you know, tricked out looking good. And in fact, when I started in the brewing business, I actually bought one of those because I just figured that's what brewers wear. Fritz would be there, and you know, he'd have a beer and shoot the bull with us. And he was always a very sharp guy, but you know, friendly.
Yeah. And Mark, go ahead, Mark.
I was just saying that in our bar, we always had a brewery coffee maker, and we had a very nice lunchroom, but Fritz wanted the coffee maker at the bar. So anybody who came in to get coffee on their break or throughout the day, they had to come into the bar, and Fritz had to go into the bar to get his coffee. And one of the reasons he did that, because in the afternoon, the tour would be there. And so a guy'd come in to get a beer or a cup of coffee, and no doubt somebody on the tour would start to talk to him. And he had these great exchanges going. And Fritz was always very accessible, you know. There were days that he was busy, but he was always accessible.
You know, Mark, that's exactly, it's funny because we adopted that at our brewery, that when you take a tour, a walking tour, a self-guided tour around our brewery, you literally can walk through the brewery and you're interfaced with brewers the whole way. Cause the brewers, you know, usually they're wearing a brewery shirt with their name on it, and it allows the brewers to interact with the customers. So the customers know that this is a real honest to gosh brewery. The beer is not being made in China and being shipped over here. It's made by real local people. And it also is good for the brewers because they say, wow, you know, these people are passionate. I got to do a good job because these people are drinking my beer.
Oh yeah.
And it means something.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. And Mike, I have one question about, steam beer that has never been clear to me, and this might sound funny, but what is it? Like, I have never been 100% clear on what exactly a steam beer is, other than that it tastes very good. But what's the line of demarcation between that and other beers, I guess?
Well, I'll tell you my story, the one I believe.
I like this.
By the way, there's a book been out probably more than a year now of the history of Anchor Brewing Company, written by Dave Burkhart. And it's a really good, it's an unbelievable book from the very beginning. It's just a great story of not just what Fritz did, but certainly a lot of that, but what the whole brewery was. And Dave has a couple of stories in there why they call it steam beer, but most of which I don't believe. But I'll tell you the one I believe. Is that what happened is in California, there were no breweries. yeah, wine drinkers. They're mainly Spanish-speaking people living here, and they drank wine, not beer. But then you had the gold rush. You had the, a lot of Europeans coming out, northern Europeans coming
1849.
Out. Yeah, gold was discovered, and a huge rush of people. And so their brewers followed the miners, and they started to set up breweries. But they really couldn't make real lager beer because they didn't have refrigeration.
No ice.
So they used English ale methods, really, is what they were doing. But there were at least some that trying to make kind of a lager beer. There's a Kreuzing process, which is the second fermentation where you take a freshly fermenting beer, mix it with a one that's pretty much done, and they do that in a barrel, and it finishes fermenting, and you have a carbonated beer. And it was a German method, and so they did that, but they did it at these warmer temperatures, and the carbonation levels would get pretty high, but they would also be being served in bars without refrigeration. And so when they tapped the kegs, that beer would be really foamy. It's just like if you had a party today and the beer's too warm, you just get a bunch of foam. You let it settle, then you add some more beer. And somebody said, well, it looked like you were trying to tap a keg filled with steam. Steam was very modern then. And it was just a nickname that took on for these highly carbonated beers. One of the stories that Dave tells in his book is that, you know, we had the cool ships at the top level of the brewery. And as the wort would cool overnight, you'd have condensation coming out the vents in the cool ship room. And so this condensation would be rising. And they thought, oh, that steam, you know, it's coming out of the brewery. But I don't like that story. I don't believe it, because cool ships were used throughout Europe before there was other ways to cool, and in the U.S. also. And none of those breweries were ever called steam beer. And the only people who would see that were people who happened to be near the brewery. So I like the idea of this very foamy keg, because you'd see it happen in all the bars where it was served. And so that's why I believe it's called steam beer. High carbonation and hard to tap.
Is that your understanding, Dan?
No, oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, there is a beer in Germany called Dampf beer. Dampf means steam in Germany. And I think, like Marco was saying, that when these beers were coming up, getting their names at first, steam was sort of a new, coming from the age of the horse to the age of the machine. And steam was the first source of power. So steam was kind of a sexy, cool thing, like when Fritz came up with the name micro. This is, you know, when microcomputers and Microsoft, and so that was kind of a cool word. So I'm sure that steam was on people's minds, and I'm sure makes perfect sense to me that that when you tap a keg that's under a lot of pressure, it would be like steam.
You know, the dump beer, he didn't start until he visited our brewery.
No way, really?
That is awesome.
I didn't know that. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
But, you know, they used to make this style of beer, these lager beers made at ale temperatures in Alaska, and I think in Alaska and in California. And there used to be, I think, a lot of steam beers in the 1800s. But along the West Coast, because the temperature was moderate, mm-hmm. so it was cool enough that you could make a proper beer, but too warm to make a lager beer. But lager beer was kind of what people wanted. So I think this was a creative solution that people came up with, I think.
And then when you get like sort of a novel name on it.
Before Prohibition, you're right, Dan, there were many steam beer breweries. But as soon as they could build ice houses, they did. And I think the first real lager beer was up by Truckee in Boca, California.
Okay.
Where they harvested ice. And then it just took over. But steam beer hung on in San Francisco because of the climate of San Francisco, because you could over in Sacramento, you couldn't brew year round with our method.
Well, yeah, I mean, Sacramento in the summer gets up to 100 degrees, whereas, you know, in parts of San Francisco, as we all three of us know, in the summertime, it can be 55, 60 degrees.
Oh, San Francisco is perfect. San Francisco has a perfect climate for me in particular, I think.
Yeah, when I first moved to Wisconsin and dealt with the, you know, July 4th humidity, I was blown away because... And when I grew up, you know, it was San Francisco. It was windy, and you wore a jacket, you wore a sweater, or a windbreaker, especially if you're down, you know, near the water, near the bay. It's chilly.
Well, one of the things I enjoy about this about a brewery like Anchor is it goes back so long, and it stretches over a period that's so vast that you get these little like funny points in its story. And I was doing some research on it just because like, oh, I got to renew my knowledge on Anchor to talk to Mark. And it got to the prohibition history of Anchor, and it was one line, and it was, "There is no record of what Anchor Brewing was doing during Prohibition." And to me, that is like the funniest, like say it, but don't say it kind of line. Yeah. You know what I mean? Cause it seemed like they were saying like, oh, you'll ask what Anchor was doing. Right. Was there any indication to you, Mark, what Anchor was doing during Prohibition?
The only thing, I think they had to be making beer in some, I don't know what quantity, but, and the only evidence I ever really had of that is there was a guy who came by, he was an avid home brewer. He's an older guy. He'd probably be late 90s now if he's still around. But he grew up on Petrillo Hill in a which was all a Slavic neighborhood. And
raised on Petrillo Hill. If that for whatever that's worth.
There you go. So ask him. But but the Anchor Brewery was in that neighborhood back then. Actually, only a couple blocks away from where we are now. But he said during Prohibition, you know, for weddings and stuff, they always had Anchor steam beer. So that's really the only indication. But I kind of believe they were. And the reason for that is, you know, the breweries that have refrigeration would make ice cream or soda pop or something to stay in business or near beer. But with Anchor, there was no refrigeration, so they couldn't do that. And they did come back right after Prohibition, which indicates to me that all their equipment was still available for use. And that was a long period. You know, how would that all be sitting in a building ready to go?
Yeah.
If no one was using it, you know?
Yep.
So I think they must have been making beer.
Okay, because that's hilarious. It's like, there's no record, but they were ready to go right as soon as it was revealed.
Yeah. Yeah.
That is pretty funny. Dan, when do you first remember meeting Mark? How did you guys become acquainted and become friends?
Well, I think, you know, we were both members of the Master Brewers Association. So Mark can talk about, you know, we sat together at various meetings or at brewers conventions. The Association of Brewers has various meetings, and I forget, you and I went for a long walk. I forget what city that was in, but I don't know. We must have went for a 5 or 8 mile walk one day to burn off some beer. But I probably, the first time that I met Mark is coming by the brewery. Alan Kornhauser, that's how I met him. I was another brewer that was there for a long time. I didn't really know Gordon that much, but for whatever reason, it seemed like Mark and I always ended up in a conversation when I go by the brewery. I think, as I said before we started, the first time I went to the brewery, my mother and I was in high school, went and took a tour of the brewery. So
that's awesome.
That was pretty cool.
And Mark, do you remember seeing the 16-year-old Dan walking around Anchor with his mom?
I do. I think it might have been Denver where we went on a big walk.
Ah, that makes sense.
I could be wrong on that. But no, I mainly remember Dan from the local Master Brewers meetings, you know, because I liked his opinion on a lot of stuff. And
I have a lot of opinions, that's for sure.
Yeah.
It's a good thing.
There was a meeting once where they were, Bill Owens had applied for membership, and Michael Lewis didn't want to let him in as a member. Were you around for that?
I don't remember that, but I certainly remember Bill Owens, and I can imagine what Michael Lewis thought about Bill Owens.
Yeah. He wanted to keep out because he didn't have any formal education.
Yes.
And so I'm sitting there with Gorse, and I said, "Hey, Michael, if you're not going to let him in, you're going to have to kick us out because we don't have any formal education." And I said, "If you're concerned about having some control over Bill Owens," because he was saying, you know, he's a wild man. I said, "Wouldn't it be easier to have that control if he's a member than if he's not?" Anyway.
Well, you know, it's funny, Mark, I having studied under Michael Lewis, you had to refer, he referred to me as Mr. Carey. He never called you by your first name, and you always had to say Professor Lewis. And then the day you graduated, he'd call you by his first name, and he'd say, "Call me Michael." But the Master Brewers in those days, you wore a tie to the meetings, And the craft brewers in the 80s, I remember I was one of the few craft brewers that were members of the Master Brewers, and most of them were older guys from large breweries, and they were very skeptical of these hippies. And you know, you wore a tie to these meetings, and they were proper meetings.
Your hair isn't brill creamed when you show up.
You got to get a haircut. Yeah. You know, you don't show up with a long hair and a beard. Although Don Barkley always had a beard, but that was another story. But Michael Lewis was of this generation that you are a trained, making beer is serious. It's an old boys club. And I got busy building the brewery, and I didn't go to a lot of Master Brewer meetings. And then I went back after many years, and I showed up in a sports coat and a tie like you're supposed to.
Yeah.
And there
yeah.
were all of these craft brewers there with shorts on and ponytails and, you know, earrings and, you know, stretched out T-shirts.
And a red Solo cup, like, yeah, hey, exactly. Cheers.
And flip-flops. And they looked at me like I was from Mars. And I quickly had to adjust that you don't wear ties to the Master Brewer meetings anymore. And it was...
Yeah.
Quite a cultural shift.
It became a come-as-you-are kind of industry.
Very much so.
Well, what was that like for you?
It was the same thing. That for me, it affected me more that Fritz at one point asked me to go with him to visit distributors or potential distributors. And I think because he wanted to try and back off from some of that where he could and just send me. And so I would do it. I would do anything for Fritz he asked, but I always worried that he would say I had to do that full time or I couldn't brew, you know. And that never happened, thank God. So I always remained a brewer, which I really love. But to get to the point, you had to wear a jacket and tie to all the distributors. And, you know, that was a pain in the ass. Especially in the East in the summertime when it was so hot and humid. And so when the other craft brewers started coming along and all their brewers that show up at the distributors, just like you're describing for these meetings, you know, flannel shirt, beard, long hair, and the distributors loved it. So it made my job so much easier, you know. It didn't happen till the end. But it happened at least.
They liked the distributors preferred the T-shirts and shorts.
Yes. Yeah, because they take you out to meet the bar owners and restaurant owners. And the bar owners and restaurant owners, if I'd show up in a jacket and tie, I don't think they believed I was a brewer.
Oh, yeah, sure.
What does this guy know about it kind of deal?
Yeah, that makes sense.
You remember Bob Brewer?
Oh, yeah, Big Bob. I remember Bob. Big beard, big guy.
So Bob and I, he used to come with me. We'd go together to various places, right? And we'd go in bars to meet somebody. And then we'd always be introduced. I was a brewer, and Bob represented the beer and draft beer and yada, yada. they always thought Bob was the brewer.
Sure.
And I was the salesman.
Well, his name was Brewer, and he was a big guy. Brewer. He must have been pushing close to 250, 300 pounds.
Oh, yeah. And it looked like what you'd expect a brewer.
Yeah, exactly.
So it was, I really liked it when I could drop the formal dress.
Yeah,
maybe
definitely.
More believable. Yeah,
I when I left politics and I didn't have to, you know, put on the old button down and stuff every day, it feels good.
But when I go to Europe to visit breweries, I was told by my chaperone, the person who's taking me around, you always put a coat on, always a dress coat.
Yeah.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
When you go to a brewery, in Europe still, you don't want to show up in shorts and t-shirts unless it's a new craft brewery. Yeah. The younger generations, guys in their 30s that are starting breweries, that's how they all dress, but they're very much Americanized. But if you go to an old school brewery,
like Weinstephan.
Exactly. You probably want to overdress a little bit to show.
Yeah, you're going to be in a jacket and tie.
Yeah,
I don't know if that's still today, but I wouldn't be surprised if it is.
Not so much a tie, but a jacket, a sports coat, a sports coat.
Yeah.
So the breweries that were around 500 years just got rid of the tie.
Yeah.
That is really funny. We're hitting around our 50 minute mark here, so. We're going to probably wrap up here soon, but I think Anchor just has such like a wild and awesome history, and it's just got such like a great place in the American craft beer scene that if there's anything we didn't touch on that you wanted to touch on.
I think we should talk about, the brewery for the last whatever 6 months has hit a bump.
Oh, yeah.
And I think there might be some light at the end of the tunnel, so maybe Mark might want to.
Yeah. What is going on with Anchor?
Okay, let me just fit in one other thing before we get to that.
All right.
That, the first beer other than steam beer that we made was Anchor Porter. And we made that in, I think it was 1973 that we first came out with that. And it was a real porter with all malt, but with roasted grains and the whole thing. So it was a real porter. And because Fritz wanted to get away from the dark beer with caramel coloring. He didn't like it that's what the brewery was doing. So we made our porter. And I asked him at the time, I said, well, why do you want to do this porter? The steam beer's taking off now. We're busy. You know, things are going great. And he said, well, I don't want to be just known for Anchor steam beer. I want to be known for Anchor steam beer and Anchor porter. And at that time, we hadn't sold it, but we had made a barley wine. I want to be known for barley wine and ales. And so he really did, from the start, want to have a variety of beers.
Plus, you guys really made the first IPA. I mean, you made the first American IPA. That's also ground zero.
Yep, and the first barley wine. And I think the first wheat beer. I may be wrong on that, but I think the first wheat beer.
No, I made a wheat beer before you guys in 1983. I don't know when you guys came out with your wheat beer, but
yeah, I'm not sure. I think 84 or whatever. Yeah, so you could have been ahead of us on that for sure. But my point is, we were trying to do a variety of beers, and we did. And Prince was really a creative guy to work for. He was always looking at what we could do next. As far as Anchor having its hard times, you know, he sold the beer, the brewery, first to two guys, Tony Folio and Keith Greger, who did a lot to build the brewery. But they decided then they wanted to sell it. And they wound up selling it to Sapporo. And so people like to blame Sapporo, but I think there was just a change even with the other two guys and from a management standpoint and whatnot. At that time, when they bought it, I worked for them, I think, for either 2 or 3 years full time. But then I wanted to retire, you know, because I was getting older. I'm 80 years old now, you know. And so I phased out with
them. It's funny because you only look like, I would say you're 60. You know,
that's nice.
You're so preserved, well preserved. I think it's all that beer you drank.
It's all that beer. But I started phasing out for a few years with those guys, and then I was completely out by the time Sapporo bought it, you know. So I had a fabulous career. I was there 45 years.
Wow.
Did things in my life that I never would have done elsewhere. And just had huge experiences. But now then they hit a rough patch and things started to slide. And mainly it's because it's happened to so many breweries. We're no longer the local brewery at the vast majority of our market. And especially on sale, everybody wants the newest, smallest, most local brewery. And so it just gets harder and harder. I was disappointed that Sapporo didn't try harder because they cut back to California, which I thought was a real smart move.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
I think they could have made it in California had they just concentrated on that and been profitable. It may have been a lower rate, but I think they could have done it.
That's the problem with big brewers is they're too impatient because running a small brewery is a labor of love, and it's measured in decades, not in quarters, you know, in quarters of profit.
Yes. Yes. But they put in a huge water treatment plant. They put in a brand new very expensive canning line, and all that is sitting there ready to go. And I think there's a couple different groups that are bidding on the brewery. There's one group that involves one of the guys who originally bought it from Fritz. And I think Fritz's nephew is part of that group. And I think Fritz may be. And so I think there's negotiations going on now. They announced in a newspaper article they were going to tell us who they're going to sell to by the end of January, which they didn't, you know. So, but we should hear sometime soon. But so much of that brewery is in fantastic shape, ready to go. So it's silly that it just sit there. Also, they opened up a brew pub across the street from the brewery, and that had been quite successful. So again, it's ready to go, you know. So I think if a new owner buys it with a small territory like California in mind, I think they could do well, you know. So I'm hoping that that's the way it turns out.
I hope they go back to their original labels. I was disappointed when the labels changed.
Yeah, that's so typical. I was just talking to Jeremy Marshall at Lagunitas, and he was complaining to me about how they're changing their labels, you know. So it's just typical of marketing sides of this business. They think they're making it for the new generation.
Yeah, but whenever the label changes, people think the beer changed. It's just subliminal.
Yeah.
And you can't really manufacture what you have in an anchor label, right?
No,
you can't
that's really a brand.
Like that's unless you were started in 18, whatever, and then, you know, built it all the way up and then made that label have it. You can't plan that out.
No.
It's sort of like if
if Coke got rid of their red, you know, their iconic red.
Yeah,
and
their blue.
It's not. It's different.
But it's different, whatever. Yeah.
But I hope the brewery comes back. And I would say that if it does come back, if you're out in California, you should buy it.
Buy Anchor. Buy Anchor beer because it's good.
Support the locals. Support the locals.
It was funny when it was announced that they were going out of business. There was this huge outcry, you know. All of a sudden, the brew pub was just getting swamped with business. I talked to one kid there who worked the morning shift, and he went home with $2,000 in tips last week.
Wow.
And I'm thinking, if all you people are complaining, just went out and bought a six-pack now and then, we'd still be in business.
What's that country, John Connolly country music song, A Man Don't Know a Good Thing Till It's Gone?
It's absolutely true. Yeah. It's absolutely. We've had some news in Madison of various breweries running into rough patches.
Yeah.
And our local beer writer, you know, every time it happens, you'll see him, you know, tweet something else like, this is why I'm always saying, if you like something, buy it.
Yeah, right.
Because there's real consequences if you don't. Because thing you like won't be around forever.
Yep, that's right.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for your time and sharing your history and the history that you were part of with Anchor with us. I really appreciate you taking the time for us today.
Yeah, that was cool.
Very good. Thanks for your interest in the brewery.
Yeah, thanks, Mark.
I absolutely love Anchor Brewing. I think it's one of the most iconic breweries America's ever produced.
And definitely.
It is one of those breweries that has lived in my mind for so long as just, almost eternal, I guess.
Yeah.
That when you see the news like it hitting a rough patch, last year, and then you hear news of, well, people are organizing to sort of see if it can be brought back. That part makes me happy because it's like Anchor needs to exist.
Oh,
in America. It is such an Americana kind of deal.
San Francisco is diminished without it.
It is. It absolutely is. There's a few of these like iconic brands in some of these industries.
Yeah, it's like if Bodine's closed,
you know what they should do?
Sourdough.
You should be able to throw a historic landmark thing.
Yeah, exactly.
On some of these brands and be like, whatever else happens.
There you
go.
You can make like Canteon. It's a brewery museum.
Exactly. Whatever else happens. This needs to exist for historical preservation.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you. Damn pleasure to visit with you.
Yeah. Thanks for agreeing to do this. Appreciate it. I had fun.
No problem, buddy. My pleasure.
Take care.
Bye.